Okay, so tonight we are continuing on. Pastor Mike started last week with the Ten Commandments. So he started with the first commandment. Tonight we're going to continue on with the second commandment. And the catechism questions that deal with those different commandments. It's a daunting task. There's a lot to cover. There's especially a lot to cover, as Mike found out, in these first couple of questions. So he's taking a couple of nights for question one, and I'll be taking a couple of nights for the second commandment. So tonight we're going to focus on what is being said by the second commandment. And then the next time, whether that's Wednesday or maybe even Sunday morning, Tim's going to be gone the 17th. So maybe even then we'll discuss the practical outworking of the Second Commandment and how that applies to us today. So the questions in the catechism, in Spurgeon's catechism, are 44, 45, and 46. And Mark, just let me know, in the Baptist Catechism, it's 54, 55, and 56. And in the Westminster, it's 49 through 52. So all three of those catechisms have these questions there. They're just a little different order. And then the Westminster and the Baptist Catechisms kind of add an additional question at the end. So there are four questions regarding the Second Commandment. So if you take a look at that, just know that I'm dealing strictly with the Spurgeon's Catechism, so it's three questions. And those questions are, which is the second commandment, what is required in the second commandment, and what is forbidden in the second commandment? The fourth question is has to do with what is annexed in the second commandment. I don't feel like we need to get into that to get the full grasp of what's going on here. So you can turn with me to Exodus 20 if you have your Bibles. That's where we're going to be, Exodus 20, verse 4. And actually, if you want to, you can go ahead and just kind of bookmark. We're going to be in Exodus 4, we're going to be in Deuteronomy 4, and we're going to be in Ezekiel 18 and 19. 18, 19, and 20. So if you want to kind of put your fingers. Yeah, it's Exodus 4, Deuteronomy 4, and Ezekiel 18, 19, and 20. That'll just kind of get everybody, we're going to kind of be going back and forth from those. That way you've got them marked there. We don't have to slow down. And we're going to try and get through this quicker. We're trying to shorten these a little bit. One, because we're at a prayer meeting and we want to spend some time praying. And you guys don't need to hear my voice that much. And two, because we just don't want to be here till 9, 10 o'clock at night. I know everybody's tired, so I'm going to try and get through this. I'll shorten this down. We'll break it up over two sessions. So, Exodus 20, starting in verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. And this commandment is repeated again. Just before crossing the Jordan, Moses reiterates this commandment in Deuteronomy 5, and it's the exact same wording there. And that's Deuteronomy 5, 8 through 10. So tonight we're going to focus on what's being said by this commandment. And like I said, in the next time, Lord willing, we'll look at the more practical outworkings of that. So the second commandment can be broken down into four parts. Right? If we look at that closely, we can look at four different parts to that commandment. Number one, what is being forbidden? What is being forbidden? Number two, why is it being forbidden? Why is it being forbidden? Number three, the punishment for doing what is forbidden. And then number four, the reward for keeping the commandment. God establishes monotheism, one God, in the first commandment. And Mike talked about that on Wednesday. The idea of monotheism wasn't even necessarily in question with the Israelites during this time. they kind of had this idea of God, Yahweh, being our national God, but we have still individual gods in our home. We still have these idols in our home. There was this idea that, yes, we trust Yahweh as our one God above all the other gods, but there are other gods, and we still have them idolized in our homes and in our worship. But God here is establishing monotheism. He says they're to have no other gods than the God who brought them out of Egypt. Okay. There's only one true God. We know that. Big G God. There are many little g gods, and Paul talks about those in Corinthians, about how they're not really gods at all. But there are many little g gods represented by idols throughout the pagan world. In fact, Israel had just come out of Egypt. They were serving in Egypt for 400 years, living in a pagan society. And according to Ezekiel 20, which we'll get into next time, Egypt, during their time in Israel, had turned to those pagan gods. Once again, there's some speculation about, well, they still had Yahweh as their national god, but individually they followed the pagan gods of the Egyptians. Israel did not turn from their idols then. God warns them during that time, you need to turn from your idols. They didn't do that then. As we saw in our introduction to the Ten Commandments last time, they didn't turn from idols even after hearing the commandments they were given. So maybe we could give them a little bit of leeway before this commandment, but they've just sat and heard God tell them, don't have any idols. There's no excuse. They no longer have any excuse. So their continued idolatry and pagan worship is even more frightening, really. So here in our text today, we see that God is clearly calling an end to idol worship. He says here, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. The ESV uses the word carved image here, and that's what I'm reading from the ESV, carved image. Some of you may have the NASB, and some of the other translations use the word idol there. The Hebrew word there for carved image and likeness are often used to describe idols, right? So NASB translates this as an idol. And this would have been the first thing that a pagan society would have done, right? So God declares himself as the only God, and a pagan society would have said, okay, let's make a carved image that we can worship, right? Anytime a pagan god was identified, there was an image or a likeness that was constructed, a statue of that pagan god, so that the individuals could have a visual representation of that god to worship. And so they're doing that with the... You can anticipate that Israel coming out of that pagan society would have started to do the same thing. They would create a carved image of their god so that it could be displayed in their homes and worshipped. Something not only to represent the god, but also to allow the owner of the idol to communicate with that god. You could not communicate with little g gods unless you had an idol that was in their likeness that you could communicate through to that god. Pagans communicate with their gods through the idols. They feed the idols and offer them gifts and sacrifices in hopes of gaining favor with the god that the idol represents. Almost universally amongst the pagan world, we see the presence of idols, carved images and likenesses of their gods. I'm sure many of you can think of those, the little Buddha statues and these statues and amulets and trinkets and any number of things that the pagan world uses to, and by pagan world I'm saying the non-Christian, non-believing world, uses to represent their gods, right? Here, God is expressly forbidding any image used in worshiping him or worshiped in his place. And it really is telling how thorough God is with this commandment, almost as if he's answering the Israelites' thoughts as they're coming. You shall have no other gods before me, he says. And the Israelites, I can imagine them saying, okay, we could do that. And we'll worship you as our God by creating a carved image or a likeness, like we've done with our pagan idols. Right? And God says, no carved images or likenesses of me are to be made. So he's distinguishing himself from the pagan religions. He's saying, I am not like those other gods. Those other gods are worshipped by idols. I will not be worshipped by idols. He's establishing how he's going to be worshipped with the Israelites. He's establishing here with the Israel the fact that he will not be worshipped as the pagan gods through the use of idols. He's distinct from and distinguished far above these false pagan gods. And worship of him will not be associated with worship of them in any way. That's the key point this to all of this, is that God is distinguishing himself from the rest of the world for Israel. God has promised to deliver them to the promised land. So one of his first promises to Israel is that he would take them out of Egypt, out of their bondage, and then he would deliver them to the promised land. Meaning that he will be there with them. If you deliver something to someone, you are there. You're actually carrying it to someone. Right? God has told Israel that he will be there with them, unlike the pagan gods who are somewhere else. They're not omnipresent. They can't be there with them. So their idols are that physical representation that they see. He's in their presence, unlike the pagan gods, and he can be communicated with directly. He has no need to be fed or to be cared for. Like these pagan idols. Our attempts to represent God with images or likenesses will sell him short. That's what it boils down to. Anything that we can come up with will always provide an incomplete picture of who God is. And that's the real danger of idols, is that any likeness that we can come up with never be able to fully represent who God is. Okay, so is God forbidding any carved things? Are we not allowed to have statues or pictures or paintings in our homes? No, that's not what he's saying at all. Obviously, that's not what he's saying. God makes it clear in the next breath what he's saying. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. Nothing in the heavens, on the earth, or in the water is worthy of being bowed down to and worshipped. Now, when we get into the practical outworking of this, we'll start talking about some of the idols that we have that are a little bit more subtle than a little Buddha statue sitting on your mantle, or a shrine to Mary or whoever, whatever saint you happen to be worshiping at the time. But Moses goes further in clarifying this for Israel in Deuteronomy 4. You can turn there, Deuteronomy 4, verse 15. He says there, therefore, and what's the therefore, as we've been taught so well to ask, since God has revealed this to you in the Ten Commandments, and you can no longer claim ignorance, therefore, watch yourselves very carefully. Since you saw no form on the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb, out of the midst of the fire, beware lest you act corruptly by making a carved image for yourself in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the water under the earth. And beware, lest you raise your eyes to heaven, and you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the hosts of heaven, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them, things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. Kind of leaves no doubt, right? Wait, what about, nope, not that. What about, nope, not that. Right? He covers everything. All of those things have been allotted to all mankind. I, the Lord your God, have been allotted to you. And you alone, to Israel. And that's the importance of those things not being used to represent the God of Israel. Then he continues in verse 23. Take care, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make a carved image, the form of anything that the Lord your God has forbidden you. And why is that, Moses? And we get the answer to that question. Why? Why can we not make any carved images? Verse 24, for the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. And that brings us to the second point for tonight. Why? Why do we not make carved images? Why do we not worship idols? Why do we not make likenesses of God? He goes on in this commandment in our text here tonight to explain why the Israelites are to worship, are not to worship carved images or likenesses of God. He says, "For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." He says it throughout the this section of his establishment as of Israel as a nation. He frequently tells them he's a jealous God. Now we need to be careful and clarify what the word jealous means here, because that word has certain connotations with us, right? We have a human idea about what jealousy is, and jealousy is used in the Bible in both a negative and a positive sense. Being jealous here is a righteous jealousy or a perfect jealousy, something that's very foreign to us. When we experience jealousy, we're essentially seeing something that we don't have that we want, and then determining that we are worthy. We build ourselves up as being worthy and deserving of whatever that thing is. Right? I see something I want, I deserve that thing, and I'm worthy of that thing, and therefore I want it, and I become jealous. Right? We're envious of someone else's achievements or advantages. This is the negative sense of the word, jealousy. Right? So what is the positive sense? The positive sense of jealousy here is meant as a fierce protective or vigilance of one's rights or possessions. That's what Webster's defines it as. A fierce protective or vigilance of one's rights or possessions. And probably a better way to define that jealousy here is to say very watchful or careful in guarding or keeping. Right? Oftentimes in the scripture, this is used to describe the feelings a husband has for a wife. Not that our wives are our possessions, but that we see that we are jealous of our wives and that we are keep careful watch over them. God's interaction with Israel, and he often talks to about them as being an adulterous nation. He's being careful and watching over his bride and seeing that they've become adulterous. God's jealousy is righteous jealousy because he is worthy of our worship. He is deserving of our worship. God doesn't need or want for anything, right? So in contrast to us, he can't see something that somebody else has that he wants. He has it all. It all belongs to him, right? He is worthy of those things. He is deserving of those things. So therefore, when he is jealous of something, it's a righteous jealousness. And any seeming benign image or likeness takes away from what is due to God. That's the danger of idols, of carved images and likenesses. And he will not share any of his worship with any created thing. He is very watchful and careful in guarding and keeping the worship that is due to him. That's what is meant by a jealous God. The next time we'll talk about a little bit about God being a consuming fire. In fact, we'll see examples of those who have offered strange fire or strange worship that's not identified by God and it's not approved by God, and then being consumed by fire. Mm-hmm. He takes it very seriously. This is not a joking matter. This is not something that we take lightly at all. The third section of this commandment deals with the consequences of disobeying. Because God is a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. God here warns that failure to worship him as he has commanded and as he deserves is hatred of God. That's hatred. That seems kind of harsh, right? If you don't worship God the way he's prescribed, you hate God. You say, well, you know, I was only trying to make it easier to worship you. It made it easier for me to have a visual representation. It made you feel more close to me. Well, guess what? We don't get to decide that. God has declared idol worship and the worship of him by carved images or likenesses as hatred of him. And that should be a sobering thought that causes us to take a very close look at our own worship. Ensuring that there are no idols or likenesses in our life. Now, just briefly, I'll address this visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. He's not saying here that he will punish the sins, the punish children for the sins of their fathers. God punishes each one for his own sins, and that's in Ezekiel 18, verse 19. You can turn there, we'll read that. Ezekiel 18, verse 19. He says, "Yet you say, why should not the son suffer for the iniquity of the father, when the son has done what is just and right, and has been careful to observe all my statutes? He shall surely live. The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not suffer for the iniquity of the father, nor the father suffer for the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself." So what does he mean there? He's not saying that he's going to punish the children for the sins of the father. So what does he mean when he says he's going to visit the iniquity on the children to the third and fourth generation? He's saying that the sin of disobeying this commandment will affect children to the third and fourth generation. And how so? And we're going to look at Deuteronomy 4, starting in verse 25. Once again, Moses is going to clear this up for us quite clearly. Deuteronomy 4, verse 25, he says, When you father children and children's children and have grown old in the land, if you act corruptly by making a carved image in the form of anything and by doing what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, so as to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will soon utterly perish from the land that you are going over the Jordan to possess. You will not live long in it, but will be utterly destroyed. And the Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be left few in number and among the nations where the Lord will drive you. And there you will serve gods of wood and stone, the works of human hands, that neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. So God is telling them, he's warning them that their sin is going to affect their children and that they will be scattered amongst the pagan nations in that area. He's saying, I've given you a specific land, a promised land, and if you disobey this commandment, you and your offspring are going to be scattered amongst the idol worshipers. Right? You're not going to live long in this land. That's what he means by the consequences carrying on. We can all think of examples in our own life. I can think of an example in my own life with my parents. My parents were non-believers. They did not follow the commandments of God. And that had some effects on my life. I've been exposed to things that I probably shouldn't have been exposed to. And that's all a direct result. That's not my own sin that exposed me to it, but it is my sin, and I'm still held responsible for the fact that I've partaken. Right? And that's what he means in that passage in Ezekiel. If I chose, if I acted unrighteously, that's on me. But the sin of my parents also affected me deeply throughout my life. I think about kids who grew up in a Christian home, who grew up with believing parents. Just the exposure to the word alone at an early age, what a benefit that is. Even if those children don't grow up to be believers, the fact that they were exposed to that word, the fact that they were here on Wednesday nights and Sunday nights, is a huge advantage to them over a child of a sinner. So, that's what he means by that. So we see the effects of idol worship extend beyond the immediate generation. Even if the subsequent generations are obedient, the consequences of the disobedience of their fathers will still linger. But to those who love me and keep my commandments, and that's the fourth point tonight, God will show his steadfast love to thousands. The promise that God made to Israel was that he would bring them into the land that he had specifically created for them, perfect in every way. A land flowing with milk and honey, the most glorious of all lands, he calls it. And that promise holds true for us today. This wasn't a promise made just to the Israelites. It is a promise that holds true for us today. If we love him and keep his commandments, he will carry us to the promised land. And before you guys get the pitchforks and tar and feather, I'm not suggesting a works-based salvation or a works-based righteousness here. I'm not suggesting that we can keep his commandments perfectly or that we can earn our way into the promised land. By grace, God has granted us a righteousness, not our own, through Christ as our Savior, who is, as we'll see in Colossians 1:15, the image of the invisible God, the only acceptable image or likeness of God, Christ himself. Right? Hebrews 9:11 talks about Christ as being the greater and more perfect tent. One of the things Steve was talking about just earlier today was the specificity that God has given Israel on how to build the tabernacle. He says, this is how I'm going to be worshipped. I'm going to be worshipped in this tabernacle, and this is exactly how you will build it. There's no room for interpretation there, right? In the same way, Christ, the greater and more perfect tent, has similar rules, has similar guidelines. We will not come to the Father except through Christ. And I think it would do us well to look to Christ as the image of the invisible God and fully understand who he is and who he's displaying himself to be to us. May God help us to love him as he deserves and keep his commandments.